Welcome to the Critical Few Actions to Improve Your Business podcast. I'm John Downes, and I'm here to help you cut through the overwhelm and prioritize what matters most to improve your business. Let's get started and discover the critical few actions that have the biggest impact. I was fortunate to be interviewed by Elise Margot on her Confidentially Speaking webinar titled, "So you've got your strategy, now what?" Elise is a nationally recognised expert in mediation and negotiation, and she helps people at loggerheads reach practical agreed outcomes so they can get on with their business and with their lives. I respect her work deeply. It was a real pleasure to join her and explore how medium-sized businesses actually implement strategy, not in theory, but in practice. During the conversation, I walked through a live case study from one of my clients, Australian Turntables, to show what best practice implementation really looks like. Here's how the interview unfolded.
So you've got the strategy. Now what? I am thrilled to undertake this exploration with strategist extraordinaire John Downes to discuss how to move your business strategy off the page to the implementation stage. John has a very impressive bio and it's very, very long, but we're going to summarize it for the purposes of today. He's had over 30 years experience as a professional management consultant, first with Deloitte in Melbourne, London and Chicago. So we've got an international expert here, and later through his own practice. John is deeply experienced mentor, helping founders and CEOs of medium-sized businesses to define their vision and their strategic plans. And perhaps for us, more importantly, it's working beside them in order to implement the plans, because it's one thing to give advice. It's something completely different to help people through the process. John does this one-on-one with selected clients and in small groups in his, and this is a plug for you, John. Okay. It's a great class, 12-month CEO masterclass, which is MBA accredited and has had over 150 graduates. So we're really learning from the expert today. Mm. John's why is to help business leaders see and be the best that they can be, so they derive pleasure, fulfillment, and earn a sound financial reward from their businesses. This is something that every business owner could wish for, right? So welcome, John. Welcome to the Confidentially Speaking webinar. It's our final webinar for this year, and I'm so pleased that you are finalizing this year's group of interviewees.
Fantastic, Elise. Thank you so much for inviting me. And it's an absolute privilege to be your number 12 in the webinar series. I feel like I'm the even dozen.
And a great even dozen. I'm going to ask a few questions of you before I dive into strategic implementation. Mm-hmm. Importantly, what do you do when you're not advising businesses, going around training people, mentoring them? Do you have a life outside of that?
Well, that's actually a very good question. I have two hobbies that keep me busy outside of family life. One of them is I've started up a Critical Few Actions podcast. Yeah. And that's been an amazing learning curve, both on a technology perspective and from an artificial intelligence perspective. But the other thing that is a recent passion of mine, apart from salsa dancing, is scuba diving. And over the last few years, really come to terms with just how much biodiversity there is on our doorstep in Port Phillip Bay. The amount of aquatic life down there is just astonishing.
Who knew?
So when you actually get underneath some of the piers and when you go and look at some of the wrecks, it's astonishing as to how much marine life there is there and how healthy Port Phillip Bay is. That's become a real passion for me.
That's fantastic. And for everybody out there, speak to John afterwards about scuba diving and where to learn to do that if you haven't started. That's great.
Certainly no expert, I can assure you.
So then I'm going to take you a little bit back 30 years. So you've been a management consultant for 30 years. What made you become a management consultant? How did you end up doing what you do now?
Well, I'll try and keep it short, but I was very fortunate when I was at university. A friend of the family had a farm in the Western District, and I got to the end of the first year of study, and the question was, particularly from my parents, was, so what are you going to do to earn some money over the holidays? Because I thought that me being left to my own devices was probably dangerous for society. And so they suggested that I go down to this farm in the Western District and do some things called hay carting, which is lifting up hay bales off the paddocks and putting them on trucks and putting them into hay sheds. Now, I learned probably as much as I wanted to really know about hay carting within about the first 8 hours. But what actually it taught me was team dynamics. We had a really interesting collection of people, each trying to do their own thing, but they weren't particularly cohesive in what they were doing. And there was a little bit of infighting and there were some different personalities. And I remember I was being driven back to Melbourne for 5 hours with the owner of the farm. And I had this captive audience, the poor guy. And he asked me this question about, so how do you think the team's going? And that was really my first consulting project where I actually gave him a blow-by-blow analysis of how the team was working and what was working and what wasn't. And we talked about the things that he could do. And that was really the start of the consulting career, which was understand a situation and figure out how you can improve it.
That's fantastic. And then how did you segue from advising someone in a car after picking up pay to actually working for Deloitte?
Well, I finished my economics and politics degree with a major in information technology and was fortunate to join Deloitte Haskins and Sells when it was one of the big eight accounting firms. And they put me straight into the computing part of the business. And then I moved into corporate finance because I could use my IT skills with these things that we had now, which were new spreadsheeting tools. And I really wanted to get involved in helping people make decisions. So I was fortunate to spend 3 years in London in the largest corporate finance team in Europe, working on very large acquisitions and disposals and so on. And then when I came back to Melbourne, I moved into the consulting business formally. And we started working on large government projects like the outsourcing of a lot of the government business processes. Then I was transferred to Chicago to help Deloitte develop its consulting methodologies. And I was fortunate to have a virtual team of over 200 people that we worked with around the world to bring the best of consulting methodology back into a centralized form.
It's quite amazing what you've achieved. And now you've brought all that experience and expertise back into the smaller, medium-sized businesses. How would you describe that transition? Because we, you know, the big companies with so much money in their budget where they can bring on a massive group of consultants, not to say that's always the best thing, but they can, to dealing with people who have budgetary concerns and it's really their baby, it's their business that they're trying to build.
Yeah. And I think this is sort of where my personality sort of took hold of me. I worked for probably 15, maybe 20 years with large corporates and large government. And I worked with some fantastic people within Deloitte and fantastic people within the clients. But one of the things that I found frustrating was the speed of decision-making in large organisations is somewhat slow. There's lots of accountability, there's lots of committees, and they have lots of stakeholders that they have to satisfy. So that's not unreasonable. But it was frustrating for somebody like me who liked the speed of working with small clients. I'd had small clients all the time that I was with Deloitte, as well as the larger clients. And, you know, I loved going out to see clients, learn about what they were doing, figure out what the issues were and make a few suggestions. What I found was if the suggestions were any good, by the time I hit the car park, they'd started doing work on them. If they hadn't started working on them by the time I hit the car park, it probably wasn't that good an idea or I hadn't sold it to them well enough. So, you know, I always had this passion for working with small and medium-sized businesses. And so late in my Deloitte career, I helped establish the mid-market consulting practice that just focused on middle-market clients. Now, one of the things that, to come back to your question, that transition was actually quite interesting. I think, and I say this quite often, that it probably took me a good 2 years to speak the language of medium businesses because, you know, when you're working with multinationals and large organizations, you know, most of your conversations are in three-syllable words and you're talking about the common vernacular of the sorts of change management or process redesign discussions. That's something that normal people who aren't in that sort of environment don't talk about at all. And so it took me a couple of years to learn to speak English, as I say it, so that I was able to communicate effectively with medium businesses. So the reality is working with the medium business founders and their CEOs is just such a privilege and a pure delight because they take you into their confidence. They have conversations with you that they often can't have with anybody else. They can't have some of these conversations with their staff. They can't have conversations with their partner when they're staring at the ceiling at 3 a.m, thinking about meeting payroll this next week. They don't get intelligent conversations back from some of their peers when they're perhaps having a coffee or a drink at the pub, because everybody just wants to encourage you as opposed to tell you that it really is a bit shit at the moment. So having somebody that they can trust and act as their confidant, but also be unafraid to tell them that the way it is, and maybe that the baby's ugly, you know, is, I find, such a privilege, you know, and I can feel my skin at the moment just rippling at the moment because, you know, it's a joy to be that trusted.
And so let's get to the trusted and into the strategy, because I think a lot of the time, many of us, we're doing our work, we're going along, and we don't spend that much time on strategy, whether that's even negotiations. I hear that all the time. Someone says, well, we went into the negotiation. You say, well, what was your strategy? Well, it's simple. We were just going to ask what we wanted, or no real discussion. So let's play that back. So we're working with the business. We now need to think about strategy. The first step is obviously preparation. This discussion isn't a lot on preparation, but I think we need to start discussing preparation that would work so that when you come to implementing it, it actually makes sense. So talk to us about preparing appropriately your strategy prior to even implementation.
Yeah, look, and this is such an important point, because when I work with medium businesses, successful medium businesses, and, you know, in our first conversation, we talk about, you know, do you have a vision and a strategy? And invariably the answer is yes, of course we do. I know exactly where I'm going, and I think I know how I'm going to get there, but it's in their head. And because they're so intimate with what they've been thinking about, they think everybody else sort of telepathically has actually understood it in their organization as well. Or maybe they've actually had a conversation and briefed them, you know, 1-6 months ago and said, here's where we're going, chaps and chapettes, you know, follow along. But the simple reality is, if the leadership team, their leadership team, hasn't been involved in developing it, then it's actually just the founders or the business owner's strategy. And it's not theirs. And so step number one is, well, do you have a vision and strategy that has been effectively communicated to the organization? And then step number two is, well, how effectively shared has it been for the leadership team? Did they help develop it because then it's theirs? Or is this just something that you've had a sermon from the mountaintop experience and just said, okay, here you go?
Yeah.
I mean, the number of times I look at business owners and they've got this crick in their neck, because what they're doing is they're charging forward with their business while they're looking over their shoulder saying, come on, catch up to their leadership team. You know, that is a real struggle for them. And it's simply because without clarity, without the leadership team being involved, then, you know, the leadership team is constantly guessing as to where they're going next. And this is a daily basis, not just a once every 6 months sort of thing. So, you know, I think about Phoebe, who is a client I was working with just the other day, and she's got a strategic plan and she's documented it, and that's good, but it's been sitting on the shelf for 3 years. She's charging ahead. She talks about it with her leadership team, you know, every 3, 6, or 9 months when it sort of comes up. But, you know, each of her departmental leads sort of heading off in their own direction, doing their best. I mean, that's the reality. Everybody comes to work wanting to do a decent job, but are they aligned? No. And that alignment is so crucial. A different client that I've worked with on and off over the years, Aaron, you know, he's got 3 businesses. They, you know, one's in services, one's in maintenance, and one's in products. He's trying to run all 3 of them simultaneously, and he has leadership teams with all 3 of the general managers of those. But all the ideas are actually in his head, and they're constantly frustrated trying to figure out, okay, what's the vision for this week?
Yeah.
And it's pretty hard to follow a leader, no matter how much you love him, if you're not sure where he's going.
And I guess if you're not the one doing all the work all the time, maybe you don't have your eyes on the ground of what might or might not work, or your team might actually have seen things within their jobs, what they doing day to day, which could inform a strategy that makes more sense for the business. Because if you're going from the top down, you don't always see where you're heading.
Yeah, and that's so true. I mean, there's two parts to it, I think, about actually having people involved, other people apart from yourself involved. One is, it's not until we start to talk and vocalize our thoughts that, well, A, we can communicate, but more important than that, that we actually activate the problem-solving center of the brain. So if you're having one of those 3 o'clock staring at the ceiling in the morning moments where you're having a conversation with yourself because your partner's asleep or there's no one else to talk to, invariably that's a pretty unproductive activity because you think yourself in circles. But I'm sure, you know, you've been in the situation, Elise, where you've gone to someone and said, oh, look, I just want to talk to you about this thing because I'm just trying to nut it out. And you've gotten halfway through the conversation and you've just walked off and said, oh, don't worry, I'll figure it out. Because funny enough, you actually have sort of spun out of that orbit and you've actually come up with the right idea.
Yeah. Alternatively, they tell you what they think of the idea, which is also quite a good thing because, you know, you're scrolling away thinking this will really work and someone brings you down to earth and says, well, just hang on a minute. You've expressed this to me. This doesn't make sense.
Absolutely. And so that's the other part of working on a strategy with your team is because, as you said, they all come into the room with their own lived experience. They've also coming into the room with their own interactions with your customers or your suppliers or with other staff or with contractors. So they've all got different points of view and all of that's really valuable, and particularly if it's constructive.
Yes,
and respectful.
We have to keep that in mind. This isn't a let's just give Elise a blast about what we think about her. It's more if you got something to say, say it respectfully and also it's got to be proactive and make sense and productive.
And
I guess that's the conversation really before we start implementing, because if we're part of the decision-making process and you've started, I call it the negotiation. I have to throw negotiation in. The negotiation between the leadership team and the leader as to where you're going so that you work together and hear the other, that listening skill, hear the other, and then come up with solutions that work as the team, you're in a much better position, I guess, before we even start the implementation.
You are so right. The thing that comes to mind there is, you know, we talk about negotiation and really what is effective negotiation? Effective negotiation is a shared communication of positions on things, a shared communication of what we want to achieve individually and together, and a meeting of the minds as to how we can do that together. And so, you know, perhaps I can sort of share a little bit about one of my clients that I've been working with for the last sort of 10 months. And they've given me permission. So I'll talk about Australian Turntables. Now, they're world leaders in manufacturing these large discs that you can drive semi-trailers, trucks and cars onto so that you can drive safely off the street into a work site. And then you can turn around by being spun around on this turntable and drive safely out of the work site or onto a busy street if you're living on a main road. So they're very, very good at what they've been doing. And they've been doing it for 30 years. I was asked to help them with developing their strategic plan, but more importantly, with actually just growing their business. The strategic plan wasn't the question they asked for. What they said was, how do we grow our business? And so I see them as just one example of really good, if not best practice, in strategy development and implementation. So if you like, I'll just share you a bit about their journey because it really talks to this issue of negotiation, because what they've done really well is stakeholder engagement, stakeholder communication, and so on. So the way it works is we started off this process looking at, okay, so how are we going to develop this strategic plan? And what we decided to do was to run their full senior leadership team through my CEO masterclass in strategic planning and implementation. So, but the first thing that we did was we actually went before the board and we sought their guidance as to what did the directors and the shareholders really want from the business over the next 5 years. And that wasn't to set the strategy, it was to actually get some guidance around what were the sorts of factors that they were looking for. What did they want to be able to look at as a successful business in the future? if we were celebrating in 5 years' time, what would we be celebrating? And becoming a great business, not great necessarily as in a $150 million multinational, but if you think about the book Good to Great, then we wanted to become a great business, not just a good business. And there were some other factors that we looked at. Then we took that input to the senior leadership team and we went through the strategic planning process. So we looked at, you know, what's the customer's view of the organization? You know, what's our three-year vision? What's our why? You know, drawing on Simon Sinek's much applauded methodology. You know, we looked at how the business was operating on a whole bunch of dimensions and we looked at the organization performance and value diagnostic, and that looked at the 75 factors. So that process then helped us say, okay, let's envision where we're going to be and then how do we actually develop a three-year strategy to implement on a quarterly basis? And then more importantly, what's the one-year plan look like? Now, that was not a terribly involved process, but it was a very strategic process because it got our procurement, our salespeople, our staff and HR people, our finance people, our CEO, and some of the founders involved in that process. And so there were a number of discussions which were to really unpack each of those different perspectives, call them negotiations, if you will, but they were all going towards a common outcome. They developed that strategic plan, and then they went back to the board and presented it to the board for feedback so that way they were actually involved in the process, and then the board signed off. That, if I take one thing away from that whole experience, one of the comments that came out of this was, you know, this is probably the first time in a lot of years that the senior leadership team has been really aligned and the board's been aligned as well around that common vision and how we're going to get there. So that was the starting point.
And I think what's really interesting is, you know, that's everybody's involved in coming up with a plan. What's interesting for me is that you mentioned a quarterly implementation, because a lot of people, when they're talking about strategic plans, talk about 5 years, 3 years, and 1 year, and in some cases they said 10 years, which was quite interesting. But very few people, when they talk about their strategy, talk about a quarterly implementation. So let's get into the implementation.
Yeah, sure.
The quarterly implementation, how does that work?
Yeah, well, what I see is their best practice. So they had a three-year plan, which they put together what are the major building blocks that we need to have in place every quarter. And I think that gives you a really good roadmap to follow. What I get more excited about is what is the monthly plan for year one, because the reality is we struggle to actually plan with accuracy beyond 12 months. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we go back, you know, 3 or 4 years to the September or even the Christmas before COVID, none of us saw that was going to happen. So, you know, any 3 or 5 or 10 year strategy was pretty well out the window within about a month or two. But what turntables have done is they made commitments on a monthly basis for each of the departments as to what they were going to achieve in that month. And that was something that they shared as a senior leadership team, which gave them joint accountability. And it meant that they're actually all in the same boat, heading in the same direction, rowing with the same sort of force. Then what they did was they brought in this rhythm that has really worked well for them, because what they've done is, as a leadership team, they catch up weekly and they talk about what they've done, what they're about to do, and what they learned from the last week's experience. Each month, they actually sit down and they actually review how did they go with their monthly objective, what did they learn from it, because it's about learning. It's not about are you good or bad. It's actually about what have you learned, because we want to learn from each other. And again, that then feeds into, so what are the priorities for next month? And of course, whenever you talk about priorities, you're talking about negotiation because it's about, okay, well, are my priorities actually supporting or actually retarding yours? So that's an important part of that alignment process. And then on a quarterly basis, they actually have a set point and say, okay, how do we go against that quarterly plan? And they report to the board on their quarterly progress. And so what you see with that process is that there is a high level of interaction. The senior leaders aren't just talking to their peers. They're also talking to their team members. So their team's involved in delivering the work. And they're going through that continuous learning process as well. So, you know, it's been an amazing process to watch, and I've seen it a number of times, but they're doing it just beautifully at the moment, where the leadership team's consciously stepping out of the day-to-day so that they can work on their strategic activities. And that's carving out time to make it a real priority, as opposed to, oh, let's see what happens in 6 months. Did we miraculously do something? No, they're being very deliberate, very conscious about what they're doing. And they're making fantastic strides forward. I'm just so proud of them.
A really good point, because a lot of the time, if you're used to doing things yourself, especially people coming up through the smaller end of town as opposed to the big bureaucratic corporates where everybody has their little place and there's a hierarchy, often the people in leadership are people who've been on the ground and, you know, sweeping the floor if no one's there to sweep on the day. It's just everybody, you know, rolls up their sleeves and does what has to be done.
Yeah.
How do you transition from that kind of person, not everyone's like that, but that kind of person to suddenly saying, I'm taking some time off and I'm going to let you do that and I'm going to think big picture, Sky. Mm. What tips would you have to someone to get themselves into, I'm pulling myself out in from the minutiae and moving into big picture?
Yeah. Like, I think it really comes down to permission. So what I mean by that is, you know, there's out of the last 100 clients that I've worked with, probably 5 of the founders have had some sort of formal business training. That means 95% of them haven't had the luxury that you and I have had of legal or business training. Now, that's not for a minute saying that they're uneducated, that their education will be in different fields. You know, they might be specialists in microbiology, they might be specialists in electrics or mechatronics or whatever. So they're largely self-taught on how to be a business person. And they may have learned from some of the employers that they've had in the past, or they may have just dreamed it all up on their way. And so they're deeply and passionately involved in the survival of running a business and trying to help it to thrive. So that comes back to, they need to give themselves permission to step back from the business and look at it as an impartial person. And for them, it really comes down to recognizing that what necessarily got them to where they are now may not be what's going to take to get them to the future. So they often don't feel that they have the luxury of time, but they actually have to create it. And that's a big deal.
That's a huge deal, finding the time and doing that. I suppose it's like with anything, it's saying investing in this. Mm. It's almost an investment in time to do this work, whereas we think, well, I've got to just get everything out that's going to bring the revenue in.
Which is really just dealing with the urgent,
which
may or may not be the important. Taking this time out, and particularly taking the time out to work with your leadership team on where we're actually going to take the business to in the future and how we're going to get there, I'm not sure that there's anything more important, frankly. But we still have to keep the cogs turning. We still have to keep satisfying our customers. We still have to make sure that the business is running. But this is an and as opposed to an or, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And unless we carve out the time, and I have the same issue with myself, I run a busy practice, but I also have to consciously take time out to look at how I'm progressing towards my vision and my strategy.
It's so true. I just saw that we have a question. Someone has said, in small, medium businesses, the founder owner has all the power. How do you convince them to change if you disagree with the strategy or the implementation? So you're sitting on the senior leadership team, and boy, I've seen this play out. So so tell me tips. I'm on the senior leadership team.
Yeah.
This is negotiation skills. Yeah. I'm on the senior leadership team. The founder's going full steam ahead and I'm thinking, this is just not going to work. What do I do?
Well, and this is actually a question for you as well, I think, Elise. Look, whenever things get heated, then there needs to be time out. Not necessarily time out to go into the naughty corner, but time out to actually allow rationality to resume and respectful communication. If you're on a senior leadership team and the CEO is heading off in a random direction, then the question is, has there been effective communication? Has there been a mutual exchange of views? And has there been a respectful and curious inviting of perspectives? So there may be a process problem. If you're going into a strategic planning process and the starting point is that the founder says, here's where we're going and here's how we're getting there, you're not going into a strategic planning process. You're just being told what the answer is.
Yeah.
And if that person then doesn't want to actually receive any input or have the assumptions challenged or tested, which is really important because you want to know if it's going to break before you fix it or before you implement it, then you know, if that founder is not interested, then you actually have a bigger issue than the strategy. That's just the canary in the coal mine, which says that your input's actually not being respected and are you in the right place?
That's a really good observation. Can you work within it? And I suppose there's also communication skills that come into here. So the person might not want to hear little Elise put up her hand because she's never started. Well, now I have started business, but at the time, you know, never started a business before. And I'm saying, well, I think that the strategy, you know, and the person saying, well, what will you know?
Yeah.
Right. And sometimes I say it's the baby who wins the argument because the baby has instincts that we might have lost in our over the years of becoming cynical. But how do I communicate it? So it might be not me saying, you know, this is what I think about the strategy and this is what I want to implement.
Mm.
But it's perhaps turning the conversation, saying, that's really interesting. Can I ask some questions? Because I don't know how this will work and it's me not understanding you.
Yeah, yeah.
How would that work? How? What would you expect of me? If I did it this way, would that be okay with you? Wouldn't it? Mm. And maybe...
And invite a conversation.
Invite a conversation.
And exchange. Yeah. I totally agree. Whenever I'm working with a CEO or founder, you know, of course they have a vision as to where they'd like the business to be. When we go through the process with their senior leadership team, that we're going through it for a couple of reasons. One is we want to test out whether the idea is a good one in the first place. Secondly, we want to capitalize on the fact that they've got experiences that we don't have. And they may have insights into the market that we don't have. And they may have thought processes that challenge our pre-existing norms that we don't have. And if we think that we have all the answers, then frankly, we're deluded.
Yeah.
So when we go into a strategic planning process, we basically say, look, we're all equal in this room. And we set the ground rules so that we can actually have a constructive, collaborative, fair exchange of ideas. And yes, there'll be things that we might have to put into a parking lot to come back to.
Yeah.
And that may be that we come back to them one-on-one, or we may come back to them and discuss them with the group on a same day or on a different day. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you're going to develop your business, having a completely closed mindset is not going to be a recipe for success. And of course, the other thing to think about is, you know, if you've got a senior leadership team who are going to help you implement your strategy, you have to ask yourself the question, why have I got a senior leadership team? Partly because they might have skills that we don't have, but partly because I can't do it by myself. So if you're going to have a team being effective in helping you work together, you have to engage them in that process. And that's a conscious decision. So just as we have the permission to actually take time out to work on our strategy, we also need to make a conscious decision that we're not the only person in the room that has all the ideas.
And so it's basically both sides, the founder and the CEO, having the respect, not only themselves, but of the people they work with to bring them along. And it's the people they work with having and showing respect for the CEO, but valuing where they're working and trying to take it to the next step together. So it's actually teamwork, which is great.
Yeah. Humility is a wonderful thing.
So what happens if we...
Are you looking to pinpoint the areas that will make the biggest impact on your business? Check out the Organisation Performance and Value Diagnostic. This powerful tool lets you evaluate your business on multiple facets and provides email reminders to keep you on track. Head over to criticalfewactions.com.au and get started now.
Oh, I've got another question coming. How do you deal with the rigid founders? So you're giving advice. Let's say I've come to you and say, you know, John, I need some help to build my business. I founded it. I'm so proud of it. And you start giving me advice about how I bring my senior leadership team in and all that kind of stuff. And I go, well, thank you very much. But this is my strategy that I want to deal with. You're the consultant here. What do you do?
Well, I'm a great believer that she who asks the best questions leads. Many of my CEOs have heard me say that 100 times, but yeah. She who asks the best questions leads. So if I'm working with a CEO or a founder and they have the answer and they're not looking for input, they're just looking for obedience from their senior leadership team, I would start to ask questions around, so what's behind that? What does the senior leadership team bring to the party? How do they contribute in ways that you can't contribute by yourself? How would you rate from a respect perspective each of your senior leadership team? That actually is a conversation which is not about the strategy. It's actually about the headspace of the founder and the CEO. And it's not because I disagree with them. It's just that we need to understand. And by exploring some of those things, we start to unpack why perhaps maybe their strategy actually hasn't been implemented in the past. Mm-hmm. Why we're a year down the track and he's asking now for help because he's gotten no traction.
And I guess there are certain personalities, and I know one or two, who no matter what you do, no matter how you work with them, they're not going to change. They have their view and they're going to continue.
Mm.
And so basically that's the time when you say, okay, I can only take this so far. Can I say this? And then I write a CYA letter. Does anyone know? It's called Cover Your Ass. Saying this is what we've discussed, this is where we're, this is where you're at, and this is what we can do. Because at the end of the day, if people don't want to move, if they are frigid, there's not much you can do. And as you kind of suggested, if you're in an environment where that's there and there's going to be no change, you've got to then think, is this a place I want to work in?
Well, that's exactly right. One of my client selection criteria, as I may have mentioned to you, is I have a no dickheads policy. And so part of that exploration with people is to understand, if they're asking for help, are they interested in being helped? And if they already know all the answers, then frankly, I can't contribute anything because they know all the answers.
Yeah.
If they don't want to try anything different, then again, I'm not really going to be able to offer much help. So that being the case, it's my moral obligation not to work with them, because it would be taking their money for no potential good outcome for them. And that's not within my ethics.
Perfect.
If you really want to kick off your strategic planning and work in a supportive environment with other CEOs and leaders, the CEO Masterclass in Strategic Planning and Implementation is for you. This 10-month small group course helps you craft your strategic plan, present it to a group of peer investors, and develop a habit of monthly implementation. Our waitlist is open now at criticalfewactions.com.au.
And so let's talk about the people who are interested in making things work. There's been the implementation. I see a question that's come in that says, what if we've spoken to everyone and most people get with the strategy? So you've got the majority. You've done what you needed to do. You've spoken to them in the implementation. You've got your senior leadership team putting in their quarterly and monthly check-ins. But there's that naysayer. And you start fearing that they might influence the others negatively on the way. Mm. How do you deal with that?
Well, hopefully, carefully and sensitively, but this does happen. It's happening with one of my clients at the moment. Lovely leadership team. They're all pretty aligned. Mm. But there's one person that's sort of really, you know, down in the dumps perhaps, or perhaps a little bit oppositional defiant. Mm. And, you know, it's not going to happen exactly the way they would like it. They might have a different perspective. And yes, we're all heading in the right direction, but, you know, my priorities are different to everybody else's. And I really want them to sort of follow on with me because I had a good idea this week. We're going to get different personalities in any team. It's up to them and us to work with the team, work with all of the members of the team to see if we can negotiate a fair exchange of views and a fair exchange of priorities. But the reality is, if a person is being toxic to the culture of the organisation and their values are fundamentally somewhere else, then really the only thing that we can do is offer them the opportunity for them to go and do that somewhere else.
And you've got to, you can't always hold the bad
apples. We can't force people to change their personality.
Yeah.
We can't force people to change their values. And if they're really unhappy with where things are at and we're making good progress and heading in the right direction and they just don't want to be on the bus, then the best thing we can do is pause the bus and let them off.
Great advice.
And that's really so that they can be happy in their future careers. You know, the worst possible situation is someone stays in an environment where they're really unhappy.
And in fact, I've seen this play out, you know, where a few people have said to me, it took me 2 years to recover from the toxic culture I was in.
Yeah.
You know, it does have a psychological impact as well as emotional, which you don't realize. You go to work and you do your thing. So even for that person who finds it difficult to implement a plan that most people are on board about, it does affect their psyche as well. It's not easy to push. Oh, here we've got it. Another question. In small, medium businesses, there's often family members and, you know, we can't kick them out. They're a member of the family now.
Yeah.
How do we deal with the different views on strategy amongst family members? Now we're going into almost, I call it succession planning discussions, but let's go into the family.
Well, aren't families fabulous?
We'll get a t-shirt for you. Families are fabulous.
Families are fabulous. You know, the only family that is going through life without any problems at all is the one that you actually just don't know well enough. So that's my starting position because, you know, frankly, we're all human. And if there's a collection of brothers and sisters, you know, we all have different personality traits and we also have different dynamics between mum and dad and each of the individual children. Yes, they're all loved equally, but they interact with each other very differently. And each of the siblings will have differences. So that sounds like family dynamics are fairly complicated. So let's just throw a bit more complexity in there and then say, okay, so some of those family members also have spouses or significant others. So now we've got a collection of families and different spouses and significant others have a different lived experience, but they're also living with their chosen partner who goes off to work each day. And they might be supportive or they may be angry because, you know, I married this person and I haven't seen them for the last 10 years of my relationship because they've been working 90 hours a week in this damn business. So, you know, there can be some resentment built up or there can be some resentment brought home. So when you're dealing with family members, both in the business, but also outside the business, we have to take quite an individual approach and recognize that there are challenges. And accept that there are challenges that family members may not get on. And that's life. And we won't necessarily be able to solve the problem about who stole their favourite toy dinosaur when they were 6 years of age, which has been festering for the last 40. That's our reality. But again, I come back to that point of, okay, if we cannot have reasonable, respectful, curious conversations, which are negotiations, to get a mutually agreeable and acceptable outcome, then maybe forcing a family member to stay in the business because they have to or they feel that they're obligated to is cruel.
And that's, you know, where I come in. Let me push mediation and dispute resolution.
Absolutely.
One of the things we do is actually, you know, you can only have a conversation if you talk about strategy, a business kind of conversation. So there might need to be a conversation about where everybody sits in the business.
Excellent.
And part of that is the mediation techniques that we bring on board where we help families uncover what their ask is and what they want generally for the business.
Yeah.
Because when there is that, I'll use the word toxicity between the families, to then try and have an objective discussion about strategy becomes quite almost impossible. And you've got to unpack that before you can then delve deeply into it. And so I found the mediation process, even though if it's not a formal mediation where we bring the parties together and the mediator, who is an independent facilitator who doesn't care, they say, I don't care what the result is, but they help the parties talk to each other and uncover what really the issues are around working together and then put in play a working together relationship. Because only once you've done that, and as you said, it might be someone moves out of the business, or we work out who's working, or we sell the business, which could be that as well. But until we've worked that out, to then have a serious strategy discussion could be almost impossible.
Well, it can be. And you've seen this so many times, I'm sure. I mean, the reality is there's a number of dynamics in play. And we need to recognise that we actually have roles as siblings and parents and children, which are different from our leadership roles as senior members of a leadership team, as well as our fiduciary responsibilities as directors of the business, and also as employees employed for our skills. And so, you know, it's very difficult to get people to sort of see that there are certain conversations they shouldn't be having in the workplace, in the tea room, which actually should be being had in the boardroom, which are different conversations that should be being had around the family dining table in a formal meeting of the family to look at their investment in this business. Yeah. You know, so people don't see that there is those three or four different roles and different things that they should be responsible for. Quite often I do see, and it's always unfortunate, that a couple might be running the business and their domestic life is being played out before the rest of the staff members. And frankly, the staff are thinking, geez, mum and dad are fighting again.
I had one
and
case
that's not pleasant.
It wasn't just mum and dad.
And it's not dignified.
No. I once had a thing with mum and dad. Never mind mum and dad. The mistress was in there as well.
Well, and whether it's the mistress or whether it's two or three brothers, you know, in the business, they're all trying to actually figure out how they can do the best for their family.
Yeah.
If they all think that they're going to do the best for their family, but they're all doing it as they have done for the previous 20 years in completely different directions, that's a recipe for an exciting experience.
It's crazy.
And so without plugging you, Elise, this is exactly the sort of situation where it's really helpful to bring in an external mediator who doesn't have a vested interest in any particular individual in the room. Their vested interest is to come to a collective outcome. So it's not about the strategy. It's about actually helping develop the skills where they can have meaningful conversations that are respectful, to actively hear as opposed to talk over the other party, and come to an outcome that they can actually all live with.
Exactly. And that's it. We're almost running out of time, but there is one more question that's come in. What would you do if halfway through the implementation you realize that you've got something's wrong? So you thought it was a great strategy, but now in the play out, it's not working.
Yeah.
How do you pivot?
What do you do? Yeah, well, fortunately, we all had some pretty good practice of that, and that was called COVID. I mean, that's where we all decided that pivot had to be in every other sentence or conversation. But yes, our vision and our strategy is our best guess at any point in time. And so on that monthly, on that quarterly, on that half-yearly review process, we're looking to see, okay, how are we progressing on our journey towards this vision? Is it the right thing? What have we learned from our lived experience over the last 3, 6, 9, 12 months, right? If the answer is, well, I don't know, there's been a change in the political environment in a large superpower, and all of a sudden our revenue from America has dried up with tariffs, or we've seen that there is a constraint on accessing rare earths from somewhere else, or we're actually facing diabolical drought conditions, then yes, we need to say, okay, this is where we're heading, but actually where we go, how we're getting there isn't necessarily going to work for us. So we now need to pause, reflect, and re-strategize. And the strategies aren't set in stone. They're living documents, and that's why we have a monthly rhythm of implementation. We have a quarterly rhythm of checking in, learning, resetting. And at the end of that first 12 months, sure, we've got two more years of our quarterly plan to go, but at the end of that first 12 months, we're actually replanning the next 2 years and the next 3 years.
That's so important because that I love that you said it's a living document, which means you don't say, this is my three-year plan, and you just leave it there. And even if you are putting it in place, you've got to be following up on what's the next 3 years looking like or continually. And so it's an ongoing process. And I guess that's why you say we have to take time out to keep thinking about strategy. It's not a once-off tick box.
And we have to take time out to learn. Yeah. Our business and the environment around it is trying to teach us stuff every day, if only we would listen to it. And that's what that rhythm of monthly and quarterly check-ins is about, is stopping and saying, okay, what's it teaching us? What are we learning from this process? Okay, and how does that inform us?
Fantastic. That has been so insightful, John. I know I'm now going to start rethinking about it.
Thanks, I'm delighted to talk to you about it.
So thank you so much for this very informed conversation. If people want to continue the conversation with you, where can they find you?
Well, the easiest place to look is the criticalfewactions.com.au website, the Critical Few Actions, because I'm all about helping people figure out what are those critical few actions that if they did nothing else, would actually help them achieve their vision. And that's about ruthless prioritization, resetting. And at the end of that first 12 months, sure, we've got two more years of our quarterly plan to go, but at the end of that first 12 months, we're actually replanning the next 2 years and the next 3 years.
That's so important because I love that you said it's a living document, which means you don't say, this is my three-year plan, and you just leave it there. And even if you are putting it in place, you've got to be following up on what's the next 3 years looking like or continually. And so it's an ongoing process. And I guess that's why you say we have to take time out to keep thinking about strategy. It's not a once-off tick box.
And we have to take time out to learn. Yeah. Our business and the environment around it is trying to teach us stuff every day, if only we would listen to it. And that's what that rhythm of monthly and quarterly check-ins is about, is stopping and saying, okay, what's it teaching us? What are we learning from this process? Okay, and how does that inform us?
Fantastic. That has been so insightful, John. I know I'm now going to start rethinking about it.
I'd be delighted to talk to you about it.
So thank you so much for this very informed conversation. If people want to continue the conversation with, where can they find you?
Well, the easiest place to look is the criticalfewactions.com.au website, the Critical Few Actions, because I'm all about helping people figure out what are those critical few actions that if they did nothing else would actually help them achieve their vision.
Fantastic. And do you know the website?
It's at www.criticalfewactions.com.au.
Fantastic. And for those of you who want to reach out to Confidentially Speaking, this is my plug, confidentiallyspeaking.com.au. We're there for you for negotiation, coaching, dispute resolution via mediation, and of course, actually helping you in real life negotiations. So reach out to us. For those of you who celebrate Christmas, a lovely Christmas, Hanukkah, and for everybody else, whatever you do, enjoy the end of the year and get ready and have a good break before we hit 2026.
Yes.
Thanks so much.
And thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Critical Few Actions podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and grab the downloadables from the show notes. And if you found this episode helpful, I'd really appreciate it if you share it with your peers and your team. Stay focused and take action. The Critical Few Actions podcast, including show notes and links, provides general information only and is not individualized business advice, nor can it be relied upon as such. You must take responsibility for your own advice, decisions, and actions.